Session number 929.
Colonel Drummond, Reel 1. When did you join the army in the first place, Colonel Drummond?
Why or when?
When?
I joined the army in the second... I was gazetted on the 2nd of September 1927. And posted out to India to the 2nd Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders.
And why did you join?
Well, I joined, really, when I left school. I had two alternatives. One was to go into a bank at about £80 a year, rising £10 a year, which I don't think I could have afforded to have lived in London. The other was to join the army, and my father was a soldier. And so I decided to go to Sandhurst, where I went to.
And had your father been in the Seaforths?
No, my father was in the Black Watch, but I did have a great-uncle in the Seaforths. I tried to get into the Black Watch, but there wasn't a vacancy. Because you could only take so many people according to how many vacancies there were for subalterns. And there wasn't a vacancy in the Black Watch. And when you were at Sandhurst, you put down three choices. You put your first choice down, which was mine was the Black Watch, and the second choice, which was the Seaforth Highlanders. And the third choice, I don't think I bothered to put anything down.
Had there been any record of Indian service in your family?
Yes, my father was out in India. After the South African War, he went out as the adjutant of his battalion. And I think he was out there from about, I suppose, 1902, 1903, until 1906, when he was stationed up at Shah. And as I say, he was the adjutant of his regiment. And I must have had other relatives who were out in India.
Had they spoken of Indian service?
Who?
Your father, had he ever told you about what it was like to be a soldier there?
Yes, but it was very different in his days. I mean, in his days, you went off on leave for Kashmir. Instead of motoring up, you trekked up on a pony. And it probably took about 3 or 4 months, sort of up there. I mean, I think it was a very different type of country, different type to what it was, then.
But had you got the impression that it was the type of place you'd like to go to be a soldier, before you went?
Well, I think so, yes, for various reasons. I mean, one reason is that the home battalion tended, I think, in all regiments, possibly to be a more expensive battalion to live in because people wanted to hunt or stay at home, and they were quite prepared. And there was a scheme of the War Office laid down that if somebody was posted abroad from the home battalion and he wanted to stay in England, he could ask somebody, say, for £100, if we were a captain, and get us the fee, to swap with him, and the other chap would go out, so that you tended to get the chap who had possibly more money staying at home, and then the chap who had less money going out to India. You could also do very much more on what you got for your money in India. It was much cheaper living there, and also you did get a slightly higher rate of pay. And then I think, generally speaking, people possibly were nicer to you abroad in the regiment than they would have been if you were at home.
You mean your superior officers?
Yes, I think there's more friendliness out there, because, I mean, you wear all sort of, prison being racial, white people in a foreign country, or British people, or Scottish people in a foreign country, and therefore one was apt to sort of... people were sort of more friendly. I think that's another possible reason. And then I think it's a very good thing to go abroad. My father said, so it's much better to go abroad than do your things when you're young rather than doing it when you're older. I think those are the general reasons why I was pleased that I was posted abroad. I had no choice in the matter.
When did the posting come? What year was it?
Well, I imagine it must have come in September, when I was gazetted, because I went out at the beginning of October, and I certainly wouldn't have had time to have got all my uniform together.
And what year was this?
This was 1927. Because one had to get a large amount of uniform. Would you like me to say what I had to get in the uniform?
Please, yes.
That'd be interesting. My spectacles. But one had to have a light and heavy barathea tunic, a day kilt, which is a thick tartan kilt, a Saxony kilt, which is a thin tartan kilt for the evening, a day sporran, and I think everybody also had an evening sporran with different tassels. Half Mingy's hose and half white spats, and then forming his hose for evening dress, also a pair of Mackenzie hose for evening dress on a different sort of guest night to a regimental guest night, Saxony strap trews, ordinary tartan strap trews, day Wellingtons and night Wellingtons, musketry trews, light and heavy brogue shoes, evening mess shoes, evening mess jacket, which is red with gold shoulder straps, which are quite expensive, and a white evening mess coat for India, an ordinary thick tartan waistcoat, Saxony tartan waistcoat, with cairngorm buttons, khaki drill tunic, Sam Brown belt with slings for your sword, a claymore in a leather scabbard, and a tin scabbard on a blue belt with white slings for evening dress, a Glengarian badge, a topi, and then ties and shirts, a kilt apron, a blue patrol jacket, great coat, a Macintosh from Cordings, a regimental cane, and then short putties, and khaki hose tops. I think that's about the lot that one needed. Of course, when one took one white drill jacket or khaki drill jacket out to India, and then the master tailor at India would copy all those clothes for you, so that you only need to take one of those. But even so, it was quite a large amount to buy.
And about how much would all that cost? Can you remember?
I think probably about 100 or £120, of which one got a grant for about £80.
You got a grant from the regiment of £80?
No, we got a grant from the government. Highland regiments got a grant of 80, and I think ordinary line regiments, who didn't have to buy so much stuff, got a grant of about £60 or so, but I don't think it didn't go the whole way.
And did you all go to the same tailor to get all this stuff? Were
yes,
you given the name of the tailor?
Well, there were regimental tailors. I went to Anderson's in Edinburgh, and I think there was Hawkes in London, who was also a regimental tailor. And my father did actually go to Moss Bros and pick up various things cheap, like sort of ski and do's, which I didn't mention, and things like that, which he bought cheap, which saved on a bit of money. And I think I bought a cap badge, silver cap badge, which was much nicer than the other ones, cheap. And I think I bought my sporran second hand, which helped a bit.
A skindu being a kind of token knife.
A skindu is a sort of pocket knife, or really it's a hunting knife that you carry in your stocking. Skin being black, the skin being a knife, and du being black in Gaelic. But it is a sort of, really, a pen knife, a hunting knife. Thing from Dralking or cutting stago and that sort of thing.
And these other names that you mentioned when you were going through the list of uniforms, such as Mingay's hose and Saxony and Mackenzie, are all different types of tartan, are they?
Well, Mingay's is a type of tartan, but it's a red and white tartan, and on your stockings it's a red and white diced hose. It's sort of red and white dicing on your stockings. And then the other one is a tartan for a kilt, which is a thick tartan, and Saxony is a thin tartan. Rather a sort of prettier tartan than the other one.
And did you in fact use all this kit whilst you were in India? Was it all used?
I think except the thick Barathea tunic. Perhaps one didn't have to take that out to India, but certainly except for that one did, yes. At various times, because you wore on a regimental guest night, you wore a different sort of kit to what you wore on an ordinary guest night. And then on ordinary mess nights, you merely wore strap trousers and Wellington boots.
And did you find this kit suitable for Indian conditions? Didn't you find some of it very unsuitable with regard to the climate?
Well, it's all right at night, because it wasn't all that hot at night, but in daytime we used to wear, in the hot weather, we used to wear thick musketry trews and a collar and tie and a jacket made of the cloth that you wrap round your topi, which is called puggri cloth, and a Sam Brown belt, and that was very hot. And it wasn't until Colonel Anderson, later General Anderson, came out to command us in about 1931 that we changed and wore shorts and open shirts like every other regiment did.
What was the reaction of the officers to that change?
Well, they were delighted, I think, because it was very much cooler.
There weren't any traditionalists who opposed it?
Not that I know of. No, I think everybody welcomed it.
And Can you tell me about any other preparations you made for going out to India, apart from this kitting out that you had?
Well, a dentist, what sort of preparations?
Were there any other preparations that were made in the sense of injections or anything of
kind? I think I had it on the boat. We had to have a TAB inoculation, typhoid inoculation. But I rather think I had mine on the boat going out. I seem to remember that being done by the then medical officer on the boat, a chap called Major Beamish, but I can't remember. I think that's his name. I suppose one had to arrange for... Well, one banked with Lloyd's, regimental agents, and there's an arrangement, obviously, with their bank in Rawalpindi, because we were stationed, went out to Lahore. They hadn't got a branch in Lahore. I think I dealt with their Rawalpindi branch, but there was an arrangement for my pay to be paid to them.
And what type of preparations did the army make with regard to you? Did they give you any instructions about how you should behave with regard to the population and the climate?
No, not to my knowledge. No, we did have a lecture on the boat before we landed from a fellow called Colonel Pickering, who was an Indian army chap, who gave us a lecture. The only thing I can remember was that he said we shouldn't employ a Christian bearer. I can't remember anything more than that. No, I don't think we did, actually. Because I think the thing in India is when you got your regiment, you lived very much in your regiment, and they would have told you all about that. I don't think we really bothered very much about it.
They didn't give you any printed instructions?
Not that I can remember. They may have done, but if they did, I've forgotten them.
Why did he suggest that you shouldn't employ a Christian bearer?
I've no idea at all why he did, but I do remember him saying this. It's stuck in my memory. I think one of the things, one of the ways to get out of your, of course, the Hindus have this very close caste system, whereas if you're born into the sweeper class, which is the person who cleans out the latrines and things, or born into a water carrier class, you can't move into a higher caste. You're in that for life, and if you marry somebody in that caste, you're in it. And one of the ways you can get out of it is to become a Christian, apparently, and then you escape from it. And so whether this was the idea that you did get rather sort of low-class type of person as a bearer as a result of this. It may have been something to do with that, I don't know. Or he may just have been prejudiced. He may have had one who was a bad chap who pinched from him and, he was prejudiced against them. But I don't remember him saying this.
And did you, in fact, employ a Christian bearer?
Well, no, when you arrived, the adjutant produced a bearer for you, and he produced an extremely good Punjabi Muslim called Cam Dean, Q-U-A-I-M-D-I-N, Dean, who came from the village of Gelra, which is about, I suppose, 10 or 15 miles northwest of Rawalpindi in the Punjab, who was the most excellent chap, and he produced him for me. And I employed him the whole time I was there. He was a splendid chap.
In what way was he good?
Well, he looked after one very well. He treated one as a sort of child. He's older than me, as a sort of child. He was dead, completely honest, and he'd do anything within limits that he could do. I remember once up in a hill station in Rawalpindi, I had somebody came, was in some fellow called Prito Brun in the Black Watch, and he died shortly afterwards, came and stayed with the mess, and we decided, he's rather a friend of mine, we decided that we'd like to have supper in my room, and I asked my bearer, who was very strict Mohammedan, if he could cook us some eggs and bacon. Well, of course, they can't touch bacon, and so he sort of said, I know you couldn't do this. And so he said, oh, please do. And so he said, all right, I will. And so he sat with his frying pan with two enormous tasting forks, which took him about 10 or 15 yards away, no, not square, took him a long way from it, and cooked like this, so he didn't get anywhere near the bacon and got away with it. So that he would do things. And then he was, of course, a complete teetotaler. And I remember once he had rather bad go of fever, and we said we must drink some whiskey because it's good for fever. And he said he couldn't do that, and so we had to write him a chit saying it was medicine, and he sort of took it quite happily after that. But he was a delightful chap. And as I say, when we went on this frontier campaign, he was on leave in his village of Gelra. And we went up from Jhansi by train to Rawalpindi. When I got off the platform at Rawalpindi, there was my bearer in a furious temper saying, why hadn't I told him about us going on to the frontier? What was I going to do as a small child, butcher, as he called, a small child with these wild men from the frontier, if he wasn't there to go and tell me what to do and defend me and help me? He was a terrific chap. He had done two or three frontier campaigns as a bearer before, so he did know all about it. So that, I mean, a lot of other bearers would have probably taken it as a jolly good excuse not to go up to the frontier, but not him.
And did you in fact find that he was as useful as he claimed he would be?
No, he was very good indeed, yes. He looked after me and the second in command, called James Muirhead, who was headquarter company. He did us both because we had to take a barrel between two. Yes, he was very good indeed. He didn't do any fighting or anything, but I mean, he did the ordinary things that a bearer does for you, look after you and call you in the morning and that sort of thing.
Did you find that he gave you useful advice about how to go on the frontier?
Oh, I don't think so, no. I think it was all rather a figure of speech, actually. But he did look after one. And as I told you before, when I came back from home leave in 1931, there was this great craze. It always seems to be when there's a depression on. It's on now, isn't it? Great craze for yo-yo. And I came out and with my yo-yo thing, played with it in front of him. And he said, oh, good heavens, he said, no wonder the country's in a bad state. He said, all the small children in India are playing with these things. I said, but all the grown-ups in England. He said, well, it must be in a terrible state. So that he was quite an amusing character.
It sounds as though you could be quite free and easy and that he could talk quite frankly with you. Was that so?
Well, I think that's the thing I've always done. I think anybody can talk freely and easily with me. I mean, soldiers come up in the order room and want to say anything. I mean, I don't mind what they say. They say what they like. I really don't think it matters. One of the best things is the chap was one of the acting regimental purveyor sergeant, a fellow called Sergeant Slesser, who was standing behind some chap in the order room, and not in front of me, in front of the CO, I think. And this chap started to spout out rather a long story, and the Sergeant Slesser sort of hit him, tapped him hard on the back and said, keep your mouth shut when you're speaking to an officer. That's rather a good one. But I always let anybody say whatever they liked. After all, why shouldn't they?
So was this easy relationship between you and your bearer rather untypical then?
No, I don't think it was. There was another chap whose bearer was a great character, and they were on very friendly terms. I think some people were difficult. One chap used to pay his bearer, I think, 90 rupees a month. Everybody paid that. He used to pay him 90 rupees a month, but by the time he'd find him by the end of the month, the bearer usually owed him some money.
What type of things did he fine him for?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose sort of not doing this or not doing that or losing something. But the thing to do, I mean, the point is if you did find your bearer and put it in your pocket, well, the money was there to be got back. And so what you had to do, which is the heart-burning thing, was to take your 5-rupee note or 10-rupee note, if you find him, and burn it in front of him. And then the money'd gone, and they both sort of wept bitter tears because the money'd gone out of the family. But it was the way to bring it home. The money'd gone. Otherwise, it was in the family, and it could be extracted somehow or other.
And did people actually do this burning of notes?
Yes, I think I got it from some chap in the Indian Army. I did it, actually. I very rarely ever find my bearer. I don't think I ever did. Well, he's very honest, actually. I mean, they used to produce a bill for things they bought, and it was recognised they used to make about 5 or 10% on that, and nobody bothered about it. But there were, some people were rather mean, and other people, well, just a matter of, I mean, you'll get it in ordinary day life, don't you? Some people. I mean, I play real tennis, and some people tip the marker, and other people don't. Some people make a great fuss about this and that, and other people don't bother.
Can we talk about the voyage out to India? Did you sail from England?
Yes, we sailed from Southampton. I went down by train with my family. And there was another brother officer, a fellow called John Sim, who did very well in the wars, a very good soldier. He joined at the same time, and I met him on the boat. And we went on a thing called the HMT Somersetshire, which was a converted cargo boat. And there is a difference, I think, between a cargo boat and an ordinary boat, in that one has flush decks and the other has a sort of well deck. And this was a converted coal thing, and it was very rough in the Bay of Biscay, and we rolled like anything in this boat. Fortunately, I'm a good sailor, and so that I was able to eat everybody else's food.
Were you the only one who wasn't sick?
Oh, no, lots of people weren't, but I think a lot of the troops were, because, I mean, they were all bundled down the mess deck down below and had to sleep in hammocks. I think it must have been very unpleasant for them. And then one was in charge, I think someone, he was senior to me. We were in charge of, or he was in charge, and I was sort of under him, in charge of a mess deck. That's so many people in a mess deck sleeping in hammocks. And one used to have to go down every morning and inspect the mess decks and ask, you know, if everybody was all right and that sort of thing. And one was really responsible to the CO of the ship for them. But they weren't in my regiment, they were in some other regiment. But one was not detailed off. And there were about 40 or 50 of us or even more perhaps on first commission going up from Sandhurst. I think we must have been a very wild lot to the rather more staid passengers, but still, not all we were. I was just not quite 20, and everybody else about the same age, so that we were probably fairly wild.
What type of things did you do?
Well, I don't know. One used to sort of have parties and dance and sort of, and I don't know, generally sort of play games in rather boisterous way. I think I had a fellow called Camber General. Eventually, we used to sort of spend our time, we used to put deck chairs up on one of the decks, just a fairly low ceiling, and practice hurdling over them, which must have been a very dangerous sport, but we managed to get away with it. But I suppose we did rather were rather boisterous. Still, nobody really objected to us. Well, then we called in, if this interests anybody, we called in at Gibraltar, where we went ashore, and then we called in at Malta, where we drove round the island in a cab, and then we called in at Port Said. I don't think we called at Suez, we called at Port Sudan, where we coaled, and we were allowed ashore there, which is the most filthy business, coaling a boat.
Why was it so filthy?
Well, they bring all the coal up on the deck and put it down, and so that you get a lot of coal dust and stuff, and it makes a hell of a lot of noise.
It was all done by hand?
By hand, by coolies, or whatever they called them, yes. Bringing along in sacks. And then we called at Aden, where we went ashore. And then we went to Colombo, because the thing was, the boat was going on round to Hong Kong, or Singapore and Hong Kong. And we were put ashore at Colombo. We spent about 3 days on the boat in Colombo before we were taken off. And people in Colombo were very kind to us. They made us honorary members of their club. And we went there and went ashore quite a bit. I think we were rather unpopular because we used to... There were the rickshaw coolies, so we used to pull these rickshaws. And we used to have rickshaw races and pay these chaps large sums of money and say that they're far too busy playing with us, doing these races, to go and take the local inhabitants home from that club. So we weren't very popular for that reason. But still, it was quite interesting. Then we went up, and this fellow Sim, several others, went up by train from Colombo. We did go to Mount Lavinia, which is a very nice bathing place, and bathed at Mount Lavinia when we were there. And then we went up by train from Colombo, and there's a causeway across that the train goes on, and went up to Madras. And then from Madras we took a train to Bombay, and then from Bombay we took a train to Lahore.
Before we talk about the train journey in detail, could I ask you some questions about the passage out to India?
Yes.
You said that you were doing dancing and so on the ship.
Well, I mean, dancing to a gramophone on deck, that sort of thing. Not an organised dance, but sort of dancing, that sort of thing. And I suppose we all drank perhaps rather a bit and things, but...
But what I was going to ask you was, were there a lot of females on the
yes,
ship?
Yes, quite a lot of females, families on the boat going out, yes. Officers' wives and officers with their wives going out. So, yes, quite a lot of them, so that you could sort of capture some young girls, daughters of people, and... I mean, there weren't all that amount to go around, but if we were lucky, we managed to get one or two and that sort of thing.
What type of quarters did you have on the ship?
Well, we had four to a cabin. And we had a cabin which we thought was going to be rather nice, which was looked over the front of the boat, the bows of the boat, the front deck. And we thought this was going to be very nice because the wind blew in. And then, of course, when we got into out of the Mediterranean, down into the Red Sea, they put an awning up. And all the troops came out and really got the most frightful stench coming into the cabins. It wasn't really very much fun, but one did have a fun, but quite comfortable.
How did the stench come about, did you say?
Well, I suppose it's sort of what we call sweaty bodies in front of you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I remember one of the soldiers had a monkey which got into our cabin and made an awful mess of it.
Sort of wrecked it, you mean?
Well, I don't think he probably sent it in to find out what he could get a pinch out of it, but it sort of got a toothpaste and squirted it round.
What type of problems did you have with the duties you had looking after the men on the ship? Were there any problems with boredom or this type of thing?
No, I don't think any. I don't think there was any problems at all. I think the food was good on the boat. And I think one chap was taken up. I mean, everybody, we had sentries all the way around. And I think one of our chaps has run in for doing something on sentry duty. I was rather unpopular, I think, with the sergeant I used to go around, because most of the sentries did seem to go to sleep, and I used to see a wretched sentry asleep, and so I'd hammer on a table with my cane and make a great noise, wake the chap up, and I think always think the sergeant was a bit annoyed that I didn't run the chap in. But it was a very unpleasant bit of biscuit, and I think that they must have been very uncomfortable, really, because it was pretty hot down below. I felt very sorry for them.
About how many men were there on the ship?
I've no idea at all.
And was it just the one regiment, or were there several?
No, these were drafts going out to India to make their battalions up to strength. Because the idea then was you had one battalion, you had a depot at home, and then you had a battalion at home, and then you had a battalion abroad. And the battalion abroad, the foreign battalion, had to be kept up to strength. And so if you got a draft, people came to the depot, were trained, then they went down to the home battalion, where they were further trained, and when they were suitably trained, they were then sent out according to how many people were wanted. They were drafted out to keep the foreign battalion up to strength, and so the home battalion was never really up to sort of fighting strength. I suppose if there was a war, it had made itself up from reservists. And so these people would have been drafts for various regiments going out to India, not a complete regiment.
So it was a complete mixture of regiments?
Complete mixture of people, yes, and a complete mixture of officers going out.
Did you enjoy that trip?
Yes,
sounds
very
as though
much
you did.
Indeed, yes. Oh, yes, great fun. I think in Aden we tried to fish for sharks without success with a large piece of meat we managed to get from the cook, which wasn't a great success. But still, anyway, we had great fun. I mean, it was a novelty. We'd never done this before. It was tremendous fun.
Did people actually do fishing whilst they were on the ship as it was moving?
No, this was in harbour in Aden.
Yes.
A fellow called Michael Farmer, I don't know what his real name was, called Michael Farmer, he went to do Cornwall's Light Infantry. I remember he did some fishing.
And let's go on to the train journey that you mentioned when you were going across India.
Yes.
From the south to north.
Yes.
What was that like? Was it like a train journey in England?
And I think the trains are quite different. You had a first-class carriage which had four sort of large bunk things on either side. And we were four to a bunk. And then you had... I suppose you must have had a loo, but you had no food, you had no corridor, you were just in this particular sort of train. And I don't think we had a bearer, so we were rather badly placed. But normally, if you travelled in train with our bearer, I mean, our bearer would go up to the engine with his kettle at the station in the morning and come down from the engine, having got some hot water from the engine, with his kettle full of water, so that you could shave or drink.